If this is one of your first times here, I encourage you to come more than once because our services are different from Sunday to Sunday. Sometimes I do them. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Sometimes people from within our congregation do the service, and sometimes people from out in the community will do the service. Prairie tries very hard and generally succeeds, I think, to be a welcoming congregation. We welcome you. No matter what your religion is, where you are on your search, on your spiritual journey, where you are in life, no matter your abilities or disabilities, no matter your sexual orientation or your gender preference, we welcome you. We light this chalice to help illuminate our paths in the never-ending search for truth and meaning. In the words of T.S. Eliot, what we call a beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. This is a short reading that I've actually used before, so if it sounds familiar, that's why. Of course, I don't remember how long ago I used it, but I'm using it in an entirely different context today. It's by Barbara Rohde, a Unitarian Universalist layperson. She writes, "We can catch glimpses of who we are by looking at our historical past. As a denomination and as a fellowship, to know who we are, we must know where we came from and which ideas moved us. The nature of Unitarian Universalism is constantly changing, and we have no creed. Yet certain ideas have existed throughout our history. We have always believed that the source of religious authority does not reside in the Pope, or in the minister, or in a book, but within the center of our own personalities, within our deepest selves. That idea has often been corrupted to suggest that all expressions of belief are equally valid. We have always believed in freedom of thought and the expression of thought. That idea has been corrupted so that it often seems to be saying, leave me alone, rather than tell me what you see. We have always been advocates of religious tolerance, but that belief has changed from saying, I won't burn you at the stake, to saying, I won't let you know I disagree with you. In the great religious division between those who would exclude in order to purify and those who would embrace in order to redeem, we have always been with the embracers. We have no creedal requirements for membership, which is how it should be, but that does not mean we should not be passionate about our search for truth, nor that membership has no meaning." I have to make an adjustment. It's just enough of a glare there. We are passionate about our search for truth, about our fierce free-thinkingness, which the computer doesn't recognize as he works. About our membership in this unique faith tradition of ours. At least hope we are passionate about these very important ideas. The ideas that have moved us are many. The ideas that have moved us have led us to this place, this space, on this morning, and we stand. Again, we stand. Rank by rank. The words of this hymn that we sang earlier were written by John Huntley Skrine and Carl Seberg words about ideas that have moved us. Ours, the year's memorial store. Honored days and names we reckon. Days of comrades gone before, lives that speak and deeds that beckon. From the dreaming of the night to the labors of the day, shines their everlasting light, guiding us upon our way. Well, from our dreams, from the dreaming of the night, come the ideas that have moved us and that still shape us and that still inspire us to be true to all those dreams of our forebears, all those dreams of free thought, of reason as a guiding light for us. And then there's that very last magnificent line in this wonderful song. What they dreamed be ours to do, hope their hopes and seal them true. This morning I want to tell you the beginning of a story about some people from a very long time ago who had rather astounding hopes and dreams, especially given the time period in which they lived. We're only going to get into the beginning of the story today, though, because there's too much to tell in one day, or even several days. So this story will be continued. More accurately, this is a continuing story, and we're part of it. You can't tell a good story without entering into the realm of history. Please, no rolling of eyes or heavy-lidded eyes. I assure you, history told well is not one bit boring. I will also tell you something that you might not know about me. You who say that you don't like history, do not scare me one little bit, because I have been challenged by more history-resistant people than any of you will ever be now, because I have taught 7th and 8th grade history. One of the biggest challenges that the study of history presents us with is this. How do we get out of this mindset, out of our contemporary place and time, and as much as possible, enter the time period and the geographical space that we want to try to understand? The difficulty of doing this increases the further away we get from actual events. The study of history, and this is why I love it, among other reasons, the study of history requires imagination and creativity. So try to put yourself into the time period where our story begins, the 1500s. Now, I think that this time period must have been an exciting time in which to live. More than one historian has pointed out the similarities in technology, not literally in the technology, but between those times and now. We, of course, have entered that digital age, which remains to be seen what we'll do with that. But in the 1500s, the printing press was beginning to really make an impact. And I was going to write this down because I knew I wouldn't remember it. 14-something, the Gutenberg printing press. So there's that we have in common with them. But just think about yourself going through a day in your life and what would be different from that if you were going through a day in your life in 1500. I think the time period was probably an exciting time in which to live for the upper classes. That is, I guess I would include the nobility, obviously, the clergy, maybe not in rates of pay, but in where they stood, doctors, lawyers, maybe even some artists. We could spend an entire morning imagining what it must have been like to live in the 16th century. I suspect it might not have been very pleasant for us on a day-to-day basis. I am reminded of something I read once about one of the interesting aspects of reincarnation, is that everyone thinks she or he will come back as royalty, not as part of the peasantry. Well, that's not very realistic. Most of us would probably be peasants or common folks if we had lived then. Maybe, though, if we were lucky, and especially if we lived in the latter part of the 1500s, we would learn how to read. And we would have access to new ideas, especially religious ideas from the Reformation. We would be aware of ideas that could move us, change, well, if not our daily lives, then perhaps our minds and our assumptions about humanity. For our purposes today, our story will begin with a young man named Miguel Servetus, though we know him, if we know him at all, as Michael Servetus. How many of you have ever heard of him? Pretty good. And mostly, if people today know of him, it's because of something he did in the healthcare field, not because of his Unitarian beliefs. When Servetus was studying law, and he lived from 1511 to 1553, two things happened to him that changed his life and eventually led to his death. One, he read a Bible for the first time, and lo and behold, he could find hardly any scripture to support the Catholic Church's dogma. And he could find nothing at all to support the doctrine of the Trinity. I remember when I told my mother that, my wonderful, born and raised Presbyterian mother, who supported me even though I was, you know, being a heretic, going into Unitarian Universalist ministry, I remember telling her this, that there is no evidence of the Trinity in the Bible. And she read that New Testament over and over and back and forth. Finally, she said, no, there isn't. But she remained a Presbyterian. Servetus was especially upset about what he learned about Jesus when he read the Gospels. This was nothing like the Jesus that he had learned about in the Catholic Church's creeds. Well, the other thing that happened to Servetus about a year later was he happened to be in Bologna. I may not be saying that correctly. Bologna, Italy, when the Pope was there to crown Charles V as Roman Emperor. Servetus was disgusted by the whole ceremony and all the corruption surrounding it. Of course, everyone knew about the corruption. He wrote, "With these very eyes, I saw him, the Pope, born with pomp on the shoulders of princes and in the public streets, adored by the whole people, kneeling. Oh, beast of beasts, the most wicked, most shameless of harlots." That was Servetus' take on that experience. Now, Servetus was only 20 years old when he thought that he needed to take on the whole Catholic Church, but the Pope didn't pay a whole lot of attention to Servetus. So Servetus' next target was John Calvin, that wonderful Presbyterian that I've been trying to escape most of my adult life. Servetus was particularly upset, as I said, by the doctrine of the Trinity and the incomprehensible theology and worldly corruption of the church, and he watched the Protestant reformers keep a lot of that. Most especially, they retained the doctrine of the Trinity. They rebelled in other areas, but they kept the Trinity. So here was Servetus going head-to-head with John Calvin. This is a whole story in itself that I'll talk about some Sunday morning. Some of you may have read Out of the Flames about Servetus's life. It's not completely historically accurate, but apparently, but what is? Close enough. Calvin and Servetus began a correspondence of writing back and forth, and Calvin came to really hate Servetus. And Servetus was young and rash and stubborn and tended to speak before thinking, and write also sometimes before thinking. Servetus wrote a book titled On the Heirs of the Trinity. It was a bestseller. It was. It reinvigorated stalled anti-Trinitarian movements in Germany and Switzerland, but especially, most importantly for our story, in Italy. Unfortunately, Servetus's natural audience, which would be the moderate reformers, rejected him for two reasons. They didn't want to have anything to do with his book. One was they were afraid the Catholic Church would come down on them yet again, really heavily, once they read On the Heirs of the Trinity, even though it was aimed to the reformers, not the Catholics. And then the second thing was that Servetus was just moving too quickly for them. He was just way ahead of them. And they didn't know what to make of this, which of course brings up, and we can't get into this today, but it brings up that whole question and concern about how do revolutions stay revolutionary when here's this forward-looking thinker way out here on the edge of a revolution, and the so-called moderates don't want to have anything to do with that person or persons. Well, eventually Calvin manipulated the French Inquisition people. Calvin had a lot of power, and I'm simplifying the story greatly, of course. Servetus was sentenced to be burned at the stake using unseasoned logs. That's a direct quote from a document from the 1500s. I would gather that it would take longer to burn. Yeah. Well, as I said, we could spend a lot of time on Servetus, and maybe we will later in another Sunday. But if there could be a good side to being burned by unseasoned logs, there was a lot of outrage after this. And the Protestant reformers were, and several Catholics, were enraged that the Inquisition had chosen to burn this young man at the stake because of his belief that, among other things, that the Bible should not be taken literally. A reformer named Bézis wrote, "Scarcely were Servetus's ashes cold before there arose a controversy over the punishment of heretics." Now, I've defined heresy for you before, but just as a little review, the word heresy is from the Greek word heresis, meaning to choose, the action of choice, dissent, or deviation from a dominant theory. And a heretic is a dissenter from an established church dogma, but also one who dissents from any accepted belief or doctrine. A nonconformist, the dictionary tells me. Enter a man named Sebastian Castellio, a Frenchman who lived in Basel, Switzerland. He had been forced out of Geneva because he was too liberal in his religious thinking, and he became a professor in Basel, and a very important man in our story. Castellio was dismayed in part because Servetus's death by burning was the first time a Protestant had been executed for religious rather than political beliefs. Castellio did a little research, and he discovered that the majority of reformers, including that greatest reformer of all for those times, Martin Luther, they were all opposed, most of them were opposed, to the use of the death penalty for heretics. Castellio gathered these opinions together and published them in a book titled Concerning Heretics. This is a good thing for free thinkers, that is, heretics, to know, I believe, because, well, you know, that the arguments against burning us at the stake go way back. It's a good thing for us to know, even before the publication of that book in 1554. I could give you a lot of examples of important heretics of the mid-1500s, but you probably wouldn't remember them, and we do have the internet. I couldn't help but wonder, though, as I was reading about some of them, what distinguishes a heretic, a freethinker, from a cult leader? Something to think about for future use, maybe, future discussion. And another question, what is the best method for making sure that a new idea lives on? This question occurred to me when I was reading about a reformer named Schwenkenfeld. Some of you may have heard of him. If you're German, you should have heard of him. I found somebody you haven't heard of. Schwenkfeld, actually, not Schwenkenfeld, Schwenkfeld. Well, I knew about him, but I didn't remember a lot of the details. I must have run across him in seminary days. Caspar Schwenkfeld. lived from 1489 to 1561, so he was a contemporary of Servetus. He's been called the German Servetus. Both Servetus and Schwenkfeld were lawyers, and both became obsessed with theological questions, though both remained lay people all their lives. They probably influenced each other, and we know that they met several times. I am curious about whether the Free Congregation of Sauk County started out as a Schwenkfeld church. I'll have to do a little research on that. Well, almost no one's heard of him, of Servetus or Schwenkfeld, of course, but more people have probably heard of Schwenkfeld because of all these churches that got started in his name. And they're still around in the world, but they're 400 years old now. But no one really has heard of Servetus. So what's the best way? They were totally different personalities. Schwenkfeld was calm and quiet and persuasive and formed all these churches, and Servetus just kept flying off the handle. Well, we've been to Spain now and Italy and Germany. It's finally time to go to Transylvania and introduce you to King John Sigismund, Dr. Giorgio Piandrata, and Ferenc David, among others. The ideas that moved these reformers of the 1500s traveled to different countries because these people moved around a lot. They either got thrown out of their homes or they willingly left to try to find a more responsive place to have their then radical ideas. One of the Italians, they were called humanist rationalists even then, was this Dr. Giorgio, or we would say George, Piandrata. He's one of the most important links between Servetus and the anti-Trinitarians in Hungary, in Transylvania, and Poland. Piandrata apparently was an expert in women's diseases, about which he wrote a lot. And now, remember, people were starting to read. People had more and more information. So in 1540, Piandrata got a job offer he couldn't refuse. He was called to be the physician for the Queen of Poland, Bona Sforza, probably butchering that, and her daughter Isabella. Isabella would eventually become the Queen of Transylvania. It would be hard to overstate how important having Poland as its neighbor was to Transylvania. In the 16th century, that's the century crucial to our story, Poland was an amazingly diverse place. Together with Lithuania, the Kingdom of Poland and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania had the largest kingdom in all of Europe. This kingdom was based on a constitution, and the nobility elected the king. This noble class was highly educated, politically powerful, and very interested in the Protestant Reformation. Poland was multilingual at that time. There were at least six official languages, and multicultural. It had the largest Jewish community in Europe. The Polish king, Sigismund II Augustus, who took over the throne in 1548, said that he was king of the people, not of their consciences. Well, not only was it fortunate for the Transylvanians to have Poland as its neighbor, but Transylvania was also fortunate geographically. In the middle 1500s, Transylvania was a buffer country between the Ottoman Empire and the rest of Europe, which meant it was also a buffer between Islam and Christianity. Suleiman I, who ruled the Ottoman Empire during this time, supported King John Sigismund, the only Unitarian king in history. And there is some evidence that our name, Unitarian, actually came from Islam. Now, perhaps the fact that Transylvania was a melting pot of sorts helped Transylvania be more tolerant of differences. That's a theory that's kind of new for some reason in our history. So now I must introduce you to Ferenc, aka Francis David. Transylvania was an independent country from 1543 until 1691, and between 1520 and 1556, the country went through the process of converting from Catholicism to Protestantism, going so far as to disestablish the Catholic Church at the end of this change in 1556. There were three decrees of religious tolerance issued in the independent country of Transylvania in the 1500s when Francis David was the court preacher. So it's not King Sigismund who was the important figure here, it's Francis David. But David had such a huge influence on Sigismund. Sigismund took over the throne when he was 3 months old. So his mother, Isabella, of course, did a lot of the governing until John got older. The first decree of religious tolerance was in 1557. It was renewed 5 years later in 1563. And then came the famous, at least it should be famous to you, Act of Religious Tolerance and Freedom of Conscience, the one that we Unitarians know about or should know about because it was the first ever decree or edict of religious tolerance, and it's so crucial to our faith tradition. This one was issued in 1568. It is amazingly short. I'm going to read it to you. His Majesty, our Lord, in what manner he, together with his realm, the diet, they called the parliament, legislated in the matter of religion at the previous diets, just the congresses, in the same manner now, in this diet, he, it's his majesty, the king, calls himself our lord, but he's the king, he reaffirms that in every place the preachers shall preach and explain the gospel, each according to his understanding of it. And if the congregation not be satisfied, no, if the congregation like it, well, that's well, that's the word. If the congregation like it, well. If not, no one shall compel them, for their souls would not be satisfied, but they shall be permitted to keep a preacher whose teaching they approve. Now remember, this is the days of all sorts of hierarchies. In Lutheran Church, the Reformist Church, and of course in the Catholic Church. Therefore, none of the superintendents or others shall abuse the preachers. No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone, according to the previous statutes. And it is not permitted that anyone should threaten anyone else by imprisonment or by removal from his post for his teaching. For faith is the gift of God. This comes from hearing, which hearing is by the word of God. That was amazingly radical. So I guess you could say a doctor, Biandrata, a king, John Sigismund, and a preacher, Francis David, go into a bar. No, they did better than that. They went into history, even if hardly anyone has ever heard of them. I mean, think of it. This whole country is based on that edict. It came down to that, to this, that way. Just a little bit more about Francis David, because he is so amazing. Before he became John Sigismund's court preacher, and so really a Unitarian court preacher, David studied for the Catholic priesthood. Then he left that, and he became a Lutheran. Not just any old Lutheran, he became the bishop of all the Lutheran churches in Transylvania. And then he left that. And he became Reformed, which is Presbyterian to us today, or Calvinist. And he left that. Not until after he became the head of all the Reformist Calvinist churches in Transylvania. This was one ambitious guy. And eventually, of course, he found his way to Unitarianism. How many of you know about the debates back then? Maybe. The debates were television, right? The debates were the internet. The debates were radio. We didn't have those things, remember? We didn't even have the printed word very much yet. So people would go to debates. Hundreds and thousands of people would go to debates. And the debates were always about religion because religion was politics then. Well, you could maybe say it still is, but that's, you know, politics, religion, same thing. People got excited about this. So the first two debates that Francis David was very important in were held at GYUALAFEHERVAR. This is what I learned when I went to Romania, 2 months ago now. But that's the Hungarian name. That one of the tricky things about visiting in Romania is there are two languages. The Romanian I could kind of almost get by in because my French is fairly good. But the Hungarian is different alphabet, different everything. So these first two debates were in 1566 and 1568. And the third one, the most important one in 1569, was in Nagvada. Yes, I went to all those places. It's hard for us to grasp what these debates were like and how important they were. David Park likens their attraction to the same attention that American presidential nominating conventions attract now. So think about that, since we just kind of left that. For religion then was as important to the people as politics is today, says David Park, a Unitarian Universalist historian. Greenwood and Harris, in their book about Unitarian Universalist traditions, compare the debates to today's sporting events. Think Super Bowl. Well, maybe the, what are those things called? Playoffs. In terms of popularity, in terms of publicity, and what passed for media attention in those days. The king got to decide when the debates were over. These debates went on for days. And eventually, the king would more or less indicate who had won. He wouldn't come right out and say it, but you'd get a pretty good idea. First debate was inconclusive. David won the second one of the three we're talking about, and this victory cemented Unitarianism as the most popular faith in Transylvania. And as for that third one, well, a Hungarian historian of the time called it the decisive debate which produced the final triumph of Unitarianism. The debate started, this third debate, started at 5 a.m. and went on for 10 days. And people, hundreds and thousands of people went to these. And the king finally ended it by telling the two sides to, quote, this is a quote from King John Sigismund, seek harmony. Supposedly when David returned to his hometown of Kolozsvár, yes, I was there, he was greeted at the entrance to the city, and he stood on a large boulder, which became a Unitarian shrine. More about that in a minute. He told the crowd that the king was on their side, and they would not be persecuted as heretics. Much cheering from the crowd, and this exuberant bunch of people supposedly carried David on their shoulders to the town square, where, according to Greenwood and Harris, he finished his speech with such eloquence that they were all converted to Unitarianism. We need a Francis David. So, the boulder in Kolozsvár, has anybody been to Transylvania? Oh, we're going. We're all going. We're going to have a lot of bake sales, car washes. We're going. So, the boulder is the supposed real boulder is there in a Catholic church, a huge Catholic church that was originally a Unitarian church. It's right across the street from the whole administrative headquarters of Unitarianism in Transylvania. And there is the boulder in the corner. And you can't touch it, but you can look at it. And it as one of these historians said, it's probably the only Catholic church in the world that gives some space to Unitarians. David himself summed up that big debate with these words: "I follow the line of Scripture, but my opponents hid it in a bag. Their religion is self-contradictory to the extent that even they cannot present it as a whole. Nevertheless, they'll see that even against their will, God will prove his truth." In the end, and I am ending with this, but I'm going to take up this story again at some point this year, so I'll begin with this ending next time. Francis David was betrayed by George Biandrata, and David was sent to prison, and he wasn't in very good health, and he died in that prison on November 15th, 1579. I'll just briefly say for now that David refused to sign an agreement with the reformers that, okay, his reform, what he wanted, his reforms, his ideas were great, but that was enough. He could be a reformer, but he could not continue to think of more reforms. And Davi wouldn't do that. And yes, I saw the prison. We couldn't go into it because it's being renovated, isn't quite the right word. Restored, thank you. It's one of those big fortress cities with big, thick walls around it. But it gave me chills to stand where David undoubtedly stood. So it's time now to find ways to help these good ideas live on. We're the ones responsible for fulfilling the dreams of these amazing people. What they dream be ours to do. Hope their hopes and seal them true. And it's an incredibly complex history. And there were so many different influences there, beginning with the Romans. And then the Magyars and the Zeklers, S-Z-E-C-K-L-E-R-S. The Zeklers were very influential, the Huns. There were all sorts of blendings. And then, as I said, that Transylvania was a buffer state between the Muslims and Christianity. So there are a lot of reasons why Transylvania, because I asked the same question, I wondered the same thing. But we can get into that at another time. But it was a melting pot for that time, definitely. That does not mean that everybody got along. But a lot of different people lived there, and at one point the Germans got begins with a D. They got thrown out for some reason. They made an alliance. Transylvania always had to make alliances with other states because it's very small. It's I think 2/3 the size of Maine, maybe, or maybe a little bigger. But at any rate, we can talk about that later. But it was a melting pot. Oh, and I should point out that wonderful. I always hate to point this out. But in the interest of truth, that edict that was the first ever religious freedom edict included Catholics, Lutherans, Reformists or Presbyterians, Unitarians, not one word about the Jews. Did have a couple mountain ranges that were a problem, like the Carpathians. You did. But the part that we're primarily talking about is more rolling hills and forests. No, not any. It's a landlocked country, so a river or two, but a crossable river, obviously. Okay. Well, again, there are a whole bunch of reasons, and there's a lot written about this, but having different peoples be part of your culture. But again, we always have to say that there's a limit to their understanding and tolerance. I mean, it was only recently that mixed marriage was allowed and still frowned upon. A mixed marriage in Transylvania is between a Hungarian and a Romanian, because Transylvania is part of Hungary for great portions of its history. So, but it was just the right time that these Italians and people from Switzerland and Germany they had to move a lot of the time. They got thrown out of their homes because of their beliefs, their religious beliefs. And they were looking for places where they'd be more accepted. And one reason they went to the Transylvania area was it wasn't very highly populated, and Hungary too. But then, as I said, Poland, to have Poland as your neighbor at this point in time was perfect, because Poland was so open. And I'm not sure of that earlier history of Poland, why it was. I mean, who knows? Why has the United States at least said historically it is open and wants peoples? Now, I fear for our future, but we are not going any closer to that today. The closing words are these. Whosoever wishes to know about the world must learn about it in its particular details. Knowledge is not intelligence. In searching for the truth, be ready for the unexpected. Change alone is unchanging. The same road goes both up and down. The beginning of a circle is also its end. Not I, but the world says it. All is one. And yet everything comes in season. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, eat soup.